Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And we begin our program with some daily selections from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living. And we're in the February 2025 issue with the theme of radical interconnection. And this month's daily guides are written by Eugene Holden, RSCP. Small shifts in your thinking and small changes in your energy can lead to massive alterations of your end result. Kevin Michel. It has always been a blessing for me to write the daily guides for this wonderful magazine. This year is no different. The theme, Radical Interconnection, allowed me to tap into the divine all around me. It showed me that the all good of God, of spirit, of the universe, is everywhere present. As I sat with this theme and as the days went by, I realized at a deeper level that the good of God must be within us all. Together, we can reveal the beloved community. Eugene Holden has been a student of the Science of Mind for more than 30 years. For a decade, he served the World Ministry of Prayer at Centers for Spiritual Living until May 2017 and managed the department for 6 years. Holden allows vision to guide him. It is prayer that fuels him. He is deeply committed to this teaching, and his purpose is to joyfully inspire people to remember who and what they truly are. He is a spiritual life coach, speaker, and author. Naturally connected. Everything in our world is connected to everything else. Greg Braden, The Divine Matrix. Our highest satisfaction comes from a sense of conscious union with this invisible life. Ernest Holmes, The Essential Ernest Holmes. Truthfully speaking, I don't know what is meant by this month's theme, radical interconnection. From where I stand, everything is connected naturally. That's just the way it is. There isn't anything we're not connected to. The air we breathe oxygenates our blood, which nourishes our organs, which assists in keeping us healthy. This same breath has a symbiotic relationship with the plants and the trees, which are fed by the elements, some of which in turn feed us. Yes, this is a simplification of our interconnectedness with life, and this is just the start. It is one thing to talk about radical interconnection. It is something totally different to be aware of just how connected everything in our world is to everything else. This month, we will take a close look at what it means to be connected to all of life and how our awareness of that interconnectedness puts us in a position to make drastic changes in how we treat each other and our planet. It is my hope that through this month's daily guides, we become a little more aware of our interconnectedness with life, even the so-called invisible side of life, from which everything comes. Affirmation. I am connected with all of life. I cherish my connection with life. I am one with the all. Let's start with the body. And I said to my body softly, I want to be your friend. It took a long breath and replied, I have been waiting my whole life for this. Nayira Wahid. As the spirit heals the mind automatically reacts in the body. Ernest Holmes, The Essential Ernest Holmes. Let's face it, the body is an amazing piece of art. It is mechanical in that it moves. It is definitely alive, as evidenced by the fact that I wrote these words and you're reading them. The heart pumps blood throughout the system. The lungs oxygenate the blood, which in turn feeds the muscles of the hands that wrote these words and nourishes the eyes that read them. Obviously, we cannot walk without feet, ankles, knees, thighs, hips, and the upper body, too. What I find truly amazing is that none of this happens without first having the thought to take that step. Therefore, the body must be connected to the brain and to the divine mind. The body connects us with everything. Take a moment to stand outside and take a few deep breaths. Push the crown of your head up toward the sky. Now, feel your feet rooting into the earth. You are where heaven meets earth. Here's a line from a spoken artist named Talib Kweli. It speaks so nicely to our being connected. I can't see my own face without a reflection. Whether it be your reaction to my expression, a mirror, or water. I need the outside to see the inside, which is where I reside. Through this understanding, I know all things are one. Affirmation. I love my body. It is the temple of the living spirit. My body is healthy and whole. And from the Daily Word published by Unity, prosperity. Knowing prosperity frees me from worry. Like most people, I may worry from time to time about having sufficient money and other resources. It's natural to have those feelings, but not necessary to be resigned to them. I free myself from anxiety about not having enough by remembering my prosperity is not in the things of the world. My prosperity is rooted in the truth of God, of Spirit, of the universe. I lift myself out of the constricting energy of worry and fear by remembering there is no lack in God, in Spirit, in the universe. I am a divine being, a child of God, which means there is no lack in me. As I pray and affirm prosperity, I relax and begin to trust that new avenues of supply will open to me when I need them. I listen for my guidance, which I trust will lead me to perfect opportunities to manifest the supply I need. Smile. When I smile at life, life smiles back at me. Throughout each day, I remind myself how easy it is to smile. The mere act of smiling, regardless of my mood, makes me happier. No matter where I am or what I'm doing, I can always find time to smile. Smiling helps me feel optimistic, light, and joyful. Smiling is contagious. Making a simple, heartfelt connection with another plants seeds of friendliness and compassion. It helps people feel seen and valued and will likely prompt them to keep smiling so more and more people feel the same way. A smile is a balm for the soul and a blessing for all those in its path. My awareness of God's presence brings me deep joy and keeps a smile on my face. And I just want to take a moment to remind all of you that when you hear the word God, substitute whatever you use for that same experience. God, Spirit, the universe, and it will all feel good and all feel the same for each of you. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, we turn to the February 14th selection in honor of Valentine's. Love at first sight, where two deliberate, the love is slight. Whoever loved, not having loved at first sight. Christopher Marlowe. The true power of love at first sight is often missed because we insist on limiting its meaning to the sweep of falling into another person upon first meeting. To appreciate the deeper sense of this, we must uncover and reclaim the importance of first sight itself, which has more to do with seeing things essentially rather than physically for the first time. We all walk around within the numbness of our habits and routines so often that we take the marvels of ordinary life for granted. It is first sight that opens the freshness of each moment, unencumbered by any of our habits and routines. First sight is the moment of God sight, heart sight, soul sight. It is the seeing of revelation, the feeling of oneness that briefly overcomes us when nothing remains in the way. At its deepest and most real level, the notion of love at first sight is spoken of in every spiritual tradition as the reward for being fully awake. Such seeing anew restores our sense of being alive. Paradoxically, first sight is recurring. In the same way that we wake every day, we regularly return to first sight in the rhythm of our wakefulness of spirit. Whenever we can see with that original vision, with nothing between us and the life around us, we can't help but love what we see. To see so fundamentally opens us to love. To love so fundamentally is to see the world we're a part of as the vibrant, ongoing creation that it is. So it really manifests this way. At first sight, we find love. At our first true seeing, the love that is already there touches us. In this regard, first seeing is an ever-present threshold to the majesty of what is. Certainly and beautifully, this happens with other people when we, upon first truly seeing another, fall sweetly into the miracle of their presence. But this is also possible, on a daily basis, upon first truly seeing ourselves, our world, our sense of God, Spirit, the universe, again and again. I can work across from the same person for years, and one day, because my own suffering has opened me more fully than I can remember, and because the light floods that person's face, I can for the first time truly see who they are and feel love for them. I can walk by the same willow season after season, and one day, because of the sheen of after rain and the lowness of the wind, I can truly see the willow like never before and feel love for the willow in all of us. I can, in the mirror late at night, after seeing myself hundreds of times, see the willow and the light and the other in my tired face and know that sameness as the stuff of God, of Spirit, of the universe. In truth, it has never been about first meeting, though this can happen, but more about first coming into view. As a breeze all spun out lets the water go clear, we finally stop talking, stop performing, stop pretending, and all tired out, we go clear, and the heart that rests in everything beats before us. Close your eyes and breathe away your mind sight, your past sight, your future sight, your wounded sight. With each slow breath, feel the cool air of your birth sight, your first sight. Breathe slowly and imagine that the beat of your heart carries up the beginning of time sight. At the moment that you feel original, however briefly, open your eyes and bow with love to the first thing you see. And we return to Science of Mind for the personal affirmations written by, of course, Eugene Holden. Radical interconnection. I am renewed. It is written, "And be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind." Now is the perfect time to renew our minds, to return to the foundation of our lives. The foundation is love. I am the love of God, of Spirit, of the universe. I am renewed by the Spirit of love that I am. Today and every day, I am transformed by the renewal of my mind. Today I have a new thought. I am the love of God. Love is the foundation. Love is the foundation of life. It is love that breathes your breath so that love can experience life through you. You are love in action. Today, see, think, and do everything from a place of love. Love is who you are, who we all are. The love of God flows through me at all times. When people see me, they see the love. My life is guided by the indwelling Spirit of love, allowing it to be. Good is all around us. Abundance, love, and beauty surround us all the time. It is up to us to choose to see it all. After that, we allow the all good of God, of Spirit, of the universe, to flow to us and through us naturally. I allow good into my life now. I am open, receptive, and available to the abundance, joy, and grace that is life. I am the beloved of God, of Spirit, of the universe. I allow this truth to shine as my life now. I am the joy of God. Be remarkable. As we stand on the foundation of love, we become remarkable. There's no one else on the planet like you. You are amazing. So instead of acting like less than who you really are, why not be simply remarkable? I am remarkable. I am blessed with gifts and talents. I joyfully share with the world. I choose to share my remarkable self by being the light of love everywhere I go. I am the magnificent of God. And so it is. We return to Science of Mind for Reverend Dr. Andrea Earle's monthly column from the Inside Out. Always connected, always one. I can never be separated from the presence of God, of Spirit, of the universe, just as a wave can never be separated from the ocean. Dr. Michael Bernard Beckwith. I began my work career in 1968 as a telephone operator. At that time, making a long-distance call was expensive. Today, we do not even use the term long distance in reference to our domestic or international calling. This world would astonish our ancestors. We live in an advanced technological time in which we have access to connect with others like never before through the gift of FaceTime, Skype, WhatsApp, Zoom, and more. We also benefit from technology that delivers life-saving medical breakthroughs. There are apps to order dinner, share a ride, meet a new beau, and bank on demand. We are riding a profound and instant wave. Instantaneous connections can also simultaneously expose us to high-tech hacking, fake news, financial fraud, and catfishing. Our challenge is that radical interconnection requires us to break through our fears and embrace the best of humanity, even while acknowledging the worst in us. We are called to do the same with technology. Use the best it has to offer, and work to ensure we're not susceptible to the pitfalls of potential addiction or victimization. These virtual advances allow us to connect and at the same time can foster an unanticipated sense of isolation. These connections are just a heartbeat from a deep sense of loneliness and actualizing the illusion of separation. An illusion of separation imposes the belief that we are disconnected from divine source. Although it may feel real, it is an impossibility. Michael Bernard Beckwith says, "Sure, I can think I'm separated. I can have conversations and experiences of separation. However, at my soul level, I'm never separated from the presence of God, of spirit, of the universe. This is the key. We must be radical in our acceptance of this truth. We must be steadfast in our commitment to sense our oneness and stay connected to each other no matter what. Connection is an inside-out endeavor. It's up to each of us to nurture and express our divine oneness and live our radical interconnection. And from the same issue, an article by Diana Ensign, Becoming a Powerful Force for Good. Those who have great faith have great power. Ernest Holmes. While growing up in a home with a parent who suffered from the disease of alcoholism, power often looked to me like a destructive force that threatened the well-being of everyone in the household. And as a child, I felt powerless over that seemingly unsurmountable situation. Likewise, with other destructive behaviors that harm the people we love or threaten the earth home we inhabit, a misuse of power can cause deep wounds. But fortunately, as we heal, individually and collectively, we learn to adopt new, healthier ways of being. With healing, we are then able to not only reclaim our inner wellspring of personal power, but also to redirect our life's purpose. Healing within. Healing from trauma, family trauma, generational trauma, environmental trauma, is a crucial step on our path to wholeness. Understanding the root causes of old damaging patterns and uprooting these patterns in our life allows us to regain our individual sense of well-being while empowering us to share our unique gifts out in the world. As with many necessary life changes, healing is a process. We are better able to access what we need on our healing journey when we breathe, slow down, reflect, and engage in spiritual practices such as prayer and meditation. These mindful moments of calm self-reflection help soothe our hearts, minds, and weary souls. Ernest Holmes states, "I will rest within me now, and I will speak comfort to my soul." During our healing, our prayers may be offered up to the expanse of sky as we stroll through a neighborhood park. Our prayers may be whispered softly as we sit with a cup of coffee in the early morning sunlight. Our prayers may be requests for guidance. Our prayers may be heartfelt pleas for strength in the face of challenges. Our prayers may be for letting go all that does not serve our highest good. When we slow down and internally relax, we hear more clearly the answers we seek. We begin to realize that we live in a supportive and loving universe that wants us to be happy. Neither our past nor the unhealed behaviors of others negate our innate wholeness. Our healing and wholeness are always there within, waiting for our recognition. Faith for the journey. Along this healing path, our faith can serve to sustain us. Our faith in God, a higher power, spirit, the universal life force, creator, or the feminine divine becomes the bedrock on which we stand. Whatever source we turn to in times of great challenges, our faith provides a powerful reserve of fortitude that will see us through difficulties. While working on my recent book, Faith, Hope, Action, Ushering in a New Earth Era, I set my intention to spend a year exploring what we needed to learn to address our climate change crisis and environmental challenges. Initially, I felt tremendous uncertainty, fear, and doubt regarding my ability to tackle these urgent issues. But when I took the time to slow down and go deep within, I found that my faith nourished and supported me, sometimes in unexpected ways. During a solitary nature retreat, I stayed at a hermitage nestled in the woods at St. Mary of the Woods, a ministry of the Sisters of Providence in northern Indiana. One day, while out walking, I serendipitously discovered a building dedicated to St. Mother Theodore Guerin. A quote by her provided me with courage for my year-long undertaking. "We are not called upon to do all the good that is possible, but only that which we can do." Whenever we feel doubtful or afraid, our faith reminds us that we are never alone on this journey. Holmes urges us to keep in mind, spiritual mindedness is a persistent and consistent attempt to feel the divine everywhere and in all things. Our faith in God, faith in spirit, and faith in our abundant, overflowing good shows us, again and again, that we have the power of the universe behind us as we travel on familiar paths towards something wholesome, beautiful, and loving. As we move more fully into our health and wholeness, we also step more purposefully into joy. Joining forces. Watching a hawk soar a high above, gliding across the sky in effortless grace and beauty, is now the image I see when I visualize what it means to be powerful. Working with life, trusting in spirit, and knowing I am held by an invisible force is my boundless source of power. While working on my latest book, I spoke with numerous people about what we can do to care for our Earth home. These individuals offered wonderful examples of ways we can each make a difference in our world. I learned a lot about what is needed for the healthy living on our planet. Moreover, I learned important life lessons for myself. For example, I do not need to have all the answers. Instead, what helps me walk a nourishing path and live my purpose more joyfully are the spiritual practices that ground me and the faith to release, let go, and trust that life will lead me where I am meant to go. Finally, the lesson I received is that when we join with other people who are making healthy, beneficial changes in their community, we amplify our power to be a force for good in this world. As noted by Holmes, others will arise who will know more than we do. They won't be better or worse. They will be different and know more than we do. Evolution is forward. With this message in mind, I decided to conclude my book with sustainability discussion topics for individuals who want to engage in group conversations regarding the care of our Earth home. As we connect with one another, we can share our faith, our hope, and our actions for the care, love, and stewardship of this magnificent planet. Building healthy families, healthy communities, and a healthy world will take all of us. You are the person. Here is the place. Today is the time. This is the moment, declares Holmes. Together we are powerful visionaries for life-affirming, positive world change. And from the same issue, return to Reverend Jane Beach's monthly column, Free to Be, Leaning into Love. There are many facets of human love. Love for our spouses, partners, children, family, friends, pets, and even strangers, and the ways in which we feel love from them. Human love reminds me that I'm part of a greater whole. When I can stand with someone experiencing loss of any kind and simply be there for them while they navigate their feelings, my caring becomes part of their experience. When I've felt betrayed by another and I can get to a place of forgiveness, my life is uplifted. When I've hurt another and offer my sincere apology, I feel the grace of thankfulness. When I can put another, which often includes pets, before myself, I know the sweetness of selflessness. The love we have for each other shows up in many ways, reminding us that we all want to love and be loved in return. I'm more than the love I experience humanly. Divine love is alive within all of us, including our families, friends, pets, and strangers. It's the light that shines bright within me, no matter what horrible thing I've just thought, said, or done. Divine love is the love that comforts me when I'm grieving, gives me courage when I'm afraid, guides my next steps when I'm filled with doubt, and helps me like myself when I look in the mirror. With a love that is unquestionably accepting, I'm invited to remember that everything I've done in my life has brought me to where I am now, and who I am in this moment is better than okay, just as I am. Who wouldn't want to lean into such a love as that? I can now show up more authentically, as I have nothing to hide. I trust the path my life takes because I've learned that divine love is trustworthy. I can let go of the need to control the lives of others. Instead, I surrender them to the greatest love of all. Embracing a love that is my truth helps me share human loving kindness with those around me. The spiritual meaning of love is measured by what it can do. Love is meant to heal. Love is meant to renew. Love is meant to bring us closer to God. Deepak Chopra. We turn now to the January-February issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and we turn to Jackie Fernandez's monthly column, The Joy of Texts, God Does Not Have What You Need. I never met Reverend Johnny Coleman, but just three paragraphs into part one of her book, It Works If You Work It, I swear I heard her voice as if she were in the room as I read. God does not have what you need. God is the substance of that need. You do not have to ask God for life. God is life, and you are the projection of that life. God does not have what I need. I'm not sure I ever saw God as a Santa Claus figure who worked with elves or angels to make the object of my heart's desire and magically deliver them to my home while I slept. Yet, when I was a child, and even into early adulthood, I saw God as more parental, a being who would sign the permission slip granting my petitions, so long as I behaved well. Like Santa, God had a list and checked it twice, and my sense of worthiness hung in the balance. Therein lies one of the many problems of that God concept. When I first was introduced to the idea of God as substance, it seemed weird and impersonal. A God reduced to cosmic silly putty? Theoretically, it made sense. If God is a source of all that is, then sure, divine substance fits the framework. But where is the loving father, mother? A God concept of cosmic substance felt distant, lacking the comfort, wisdom, and understanding that I often experienced in prayer. If prayer was talking to God, then I was being heard. I wasn't alone. Through deeper study and contemplation, I've come to understand that God as cosmic substance is more personal. God expressing as all that I know in this world is the peak of familiarity. God expressing as me is the most intimate knowing of God. In Coleman's book, she follows the statement of God as substance with, "You do not have to ask God for life. God is life, and you are the projection of that life." She goes on to say that in this realization, our prayers must change. We can no longer petition God, begging for our heart's desire, but rather we must claim it. That seems so simple, but honestly, in my experience, this is where it gets complicated. More accurately, this is where I tend to overthink or doubt or deny my worthiness. To simply know that God is life, and I am, and you are too, a projection of that life is one thing, but the implications are all the things. The ability and the responsibility to answer prayer becomes our own. The power to shape substance through our prayers rests with us. For this reason, one of the five parts of it works if you work it, is dedicated to prayer, specifically effective prayer. Coleman claims, accurately, that the reason we do not get results is that we do not believe the words of our own prayers and therefore cannot expect God to work through us. If God is expressing through us, that cosmic silly putty cannot take shape or form into the things we do not believe. As we make prayer a habit, we bring to the forefront of our awareness the presence of God in all people and all circumstances. It is in this awareness that we begin to own the responsibility to believe the words of our prayers because we know we are shaping substance through our words, thoughts, and actions. That is God expressing through you. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you are currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. And if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio on demand. We return now to Rainn Wilson's Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution. And we had started Chapter 10, The Seven Pillars of a Spiritual Revolution. We can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them, Albert Einstein. And we are in a section that he's called, "Hey Kids, Let's Build the Perfect World." The essence of this work that we need to do is summed up by one of my all-time most cherished quotes by everyone's favorite philosopher, architect, futurist, Buckminster Fuller. "You never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete." A new model that makes the existing model obsolete? Easier said than done, right? Unfortunately, I, a mere actor, do not have the skill set to present on these few remaining pages an action plan that is thorough and expansive enough to inspire all of humanity to reorganize itself around spiritual principles. For that, I apologize. I do, however, wish to leave you with a series of key concepts and action items that I believe will be crucial in igniting a transformation. Seven pillars, if you will, on which to potentially build this movement or to at least give us a head start. It's an eclectic group of ideas that is, like the rest of the book, here to shake things up a little and inspire a deeper conversation. They are: 1. Create a new mythology. 2. Celebrate joy and fight cynicism. 3. Destroy adversarial systems. 4. Build something new. Don't just protest. 5. Systematize grassroots movements. 6. Invest in virtues education. 7. Harness radical compassion. Let's start with the most important one. This seems to be a nice timing for his book. Write a new mythology of humanity. Everything begins with a story. A story is the most powerful of art forms because it shapes how we think about the world. Remember, history has the word story embedded right in it. As someone working in film, television, and theater, I've been privileged to be a part of telling dozens and dozens of amazing stories. I've witnessed their power and importance to the human heart. I've seen stories change lives. For over 100 years, we've heard and retold the legend of the Homo sapiens, how we evolved from living in caves to living in towns and then cities and then nation-states. We hunted, killed, and conquered. We've heard about how our species was propagated by survival of the fittest, and in this dog-eat-dog world, the most aggressive and technologically advanced nations and peoples prospered, while others were enslaved, oppressed, and left behind. We're taught over and over again at school that every human undertaking is based on a quest for power. It is epoch after epoch of wars. In fact, my son Walter took a preposterously stupid AP World History class that was almost entirely made up of memorizing the dates and locations of various wars and who won them. Because, as our children are insidiously brainwashed, history was written by the victors, and to the victors go the spoils. Well, that's one way of looking at it. But what if we started telling an altogether different story? What if we rewrote the legend of the Homo sapiens? I once had a discussion in which a fascinating question was posed. What was humankind's biggest idea ever? What's the grandest concept we've ever come up with as a species? One of the propositions that arose was that money, in all its powers, complexities, and dynamics, was humankind's biggest idea to date. Sadly, I tend to agree. Think about all the various facets of commerce and capitalism and how deep their tendrils have been woven throughout the whole of human society and history over the ages. It affects every single thing we do and has a deep, complicated, and dark history as well. Madman and philosopher Slavoj Zizek has said that it is easier to imagine the end of the world than it is the end of capitalism. And I kind of agree with him. You have a thing, and I want that thing. And I pay you a sand dollar or a shiny rock or a shell or eventually, a coin for said thing. I stockpile my shells or coins and leave them to my children. The more of this money I accrue, the more social capital, clout, and dominion I and my tribe can amass. Money becomes connected to ownership and empire. We eventually create money lenders or banks that stockpile stacks of these currencies and lend it with interest, generating even more. Serfs have to pay off debt to landowners. Wealthy merchants fund sailing expeditions across oceans to bring back goods as an investment. Gold equals power. Labor gets compensated by wages in the industrial age. Money buys armies, arms, companies, land, homes, prestige. Then there are stocks and bonds and treasury notes. Then credit cards, student loans, budgets and deficits on a household and governmental scale. Subprime mortgages and global financial crises, the crypto gold rush. On many levels, the history of humanity can be boiled down to a history of money. In fact, the first known writing was a 4,000-year-old tablet recording of what? A song? A myth? A fable? A funny story? No, money. A recording in cuneiform of the wages of some Mesopotamian workers. I don't mean to indict capitalism. Many could cogently argue that all of the progress that humanity has made to this point has been due to the exchange of goods and services, and money has been and still is the most convenient way to oil the wheels of commerce that leads to humanity's social and material evolution. They would posit that the epic list of improvements to quality of life and lifespan over the centuries couldn't have happened without some kind of currency or marketplace. But at times, it sure seems like the entire definition of humanity and its journey forward is about the getting and owning of things, consumerism and materialism, the taking of things away from other people who have things. We end up with a culture that mirrors the famous quote by John D. Rockefeller, who, when asked by a reporter, "How much money is enough?" responded, "Just a little more." How much is enough, and can I make a little bit more? That pretty much sums us up. To quote the esteemed philosopher David Lee Roth, money can't buy happiness, but it can buy a yacht that sails right next to it. Surely, at this juncture in human progress, we can find a bigger, grander, more all-encompassing idea than commerce. And maybe out new mythology can also rise above the dark dystopian visions of the future that our children have been raised on through countless books and movies. A story about humans overcoming their differences, prejudices, and pettiness to create something global and beautiful, perhaps? Where is our big imagination now at this most crucial of crossroads? Here's an example. I remember in school being shown pictures of tall trees and short trees and how survival of the fittest applied to a forest. The tall trees win, I was told repeatedly. The weak trees lose and die, we were taught. The tall trees get all of that precious sunlight and grow the deepest root systems, while weaker plants struggle but eventually don't make it. Natural selection in the woods. In her nature masterpiece, Finding the Mother Tree, Suzanne Simard disproves this theory and instead shows a kind of collective altruism from tree to tree. She documents with science, personal history, and exquisite emotional sensitivity how the interconnected ecosystem of trees operates. Before Avatar, she was pioneering research into this interplay and interdependence she calls the Wood Wide Web. Simard discovered that trees and plants communicate and share information and resources like a vast green brain. The network in the soil is a neural network, and the chemicals that move through it are the same as our neural transmitters. No longer trees as solitary creations, seeking their own self-sufficiency, but repeated examples of mossy, loamy interdependence on a grand scale. Dr. Simard revolutionized how we think about nature itself. In addition to helping inspire the Tree of Souls imagery in James Cameron's Avatar and the central character of the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Overstory by Richard Powers, Dr. Simard has single-handedly changed how botanists and ecologists and treeologists theorize about how a forest works. All this by rewriting a story. A story of Darwinian survival of the fittest transformed into a tale of cooperation, connection, and mutual support, with mushrooms and root systems. Can we not apply that same vision to our rich history of human cooperation and interdependence? And can we not look forward while holding that vision as a goal? Archbishop Desmond Tutu once said, "The atomized, homogeneous groups that existed in the past are no longer the truth of our world. We must recognize that we are part of one group, one family, the human family. Our survival as a planet depends on it. We are part of one family, and we are fundamentally good. Humanity is one family, and we are inherently good." Now, that's a story for us to get behind. This is the first pillar of our spiritual revolution, the creation of a new mythology for humanity during its transformation into a lovingly united global community based on a foundation of spiritual principles instead of adversarial ones. We will not obtain this story from any current world leader, politician, or internet personality, but rather think of it as something we all visualize, create, and hope for collectively. Hope. There's an idea. This new mythology, this new story, this new big idea needs to have something in it that is unabashedly hopeful. I'll give it a stab here. It may not be right, but it's a start. The new legend of the Homo sapiens. When humans lived in caves and villages, community was everything. We sought safety, warmth, love, and family in the collective. We communed with nature, understood it, feared it, lived in harmony with it. Over the years, we aimed high and dreamed big, invented world-changing ideas and concepts, worked together to eradicate diseases, came together to try to solve problems and fight evil. Sadly, along the way, we also lost sight of our inherently sacred and spiritual selves. We found ourselves at a crossroads. Humankind had a choice: keep doing what we've always done, or hit restart. We took a bold and revolutionary path of hopefulness, relying on the idea that the human spirit is inherently good, to build a new world based on heart-centered wisdom. We left behind our selfish, aggressive ways and came together as one family. And the result? Humanity achieved peace and unity and found, dare we say it, joy. What do you think of my new mythic story? Or do you like the old one better? Speaking of joy, this brings me to my next foundation for a spiritual revolution. Foster joy and squash cynicism. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings a tune without the words and never stops at all. Emily Dickinson. I studied acting for a time with the great theater director and philosopher Andre Gregory. He was the subject of the amazing art film My Dinner with Andre. He would have tea occasionally with his students, and as I was finishing a cup with him one day and getting ready to leave his beautiful West Village apartment, I turned to him and said something to the effect of, "Mr. Gregory, sometimes I just feel so bitter, so hopeless about the future. It's so hard to not be cynical." I'll never forget what happened next. He grabbed me by the wrist, pulled me closer, looked into my eyes with a ferocious intensity, and said, "Don't do it. Don't give in to cynicism. If you do, they'll have won. They want you to be cynical because then nothing will ever change. You must keep hope alive. Keep going. Promise me you won't give in." I nodded, a bit overwhelmed, and stepped out onto the cobblestone street, seeing the world in an ever so slightly different way. I'll never forget that interaction for as long as I live. And as I write this, I realize that not only was Andre Gregory spot on, but there was most probably a pandemic I left off my list in Chapter 2, cynicism. We're all so cynical, so bitter, so pessimistic these days, myself included. I struggle every day to not give in. And the more cynical we get, the more nothing gets done because, well, what's the point? This particular pandemic is insidious because we don't realize we're suffering from it, especially the youth. To what extent is this wet blanket of hopelessness contributing to the deadly, overwhelming mental health epidemic they're suffering from? David Brooks in The Second Mountain says brilliantly, "Our society has become a conspiracy against joy. It has put too much emphasis on the individuating part of our consciousness, individual reason, and too little emphasis on the bonding parts of our consciousness, the heart and soul." I think Mr. Brooks and Mr. Gregory are on to something with this idea of a conspiracy against joy. The forces that control and shape our world, and no, I'm not talking about some conspiracy about a cabal of the super wealthy smoking cigars in boardrooms or in Davos, Switzerland, want things to stay the same so that they can continue to profit from the world staying exactly the way it is. How could we ever build a new model that makes the old model obsolete if we believe in our heart of hearts that things will never change, that they will always stay in the same messed up mode? So, what is the remedy? I propose that the opposite of cynicism isn't optimism. The opposite of cynicism is joy. Why? Well, optimism has a kind of inherent clueless look on the bright side sheen to it. And recent research in the field of positive psychology tells us there is such a thing as toxic positivity, where one can feel externally pressured to be positive at all times in a way that is insensitive to the difficulties that might surround a person. By urging people in a blanket way to always keep a positive mindset, we disregard the complexity and darkness of being human. This generalized positive attitude of optimism, frequently propagated on social media, flattens out any authentic experience and can cause shame in someone who is struggling to process superficial platitudes like "keep your head up" and "turn that frown upside down." Joy, however, inherently acknowledges sorrow. It doesn't disregard the hard stuff. Joy knows that negativity is a part of life as well. Joy says that life is hard, but there is a place you can go, a tool you can use. Joy is a force, a choice, something that can be harnessed, a decision to be made. Even if one is not feeling it in one's heart, one can spread joy to others. Abdu'l-Bahá gives us one of my all-time favorite quotes about joy. "Joy gives us wings. In times of joy, our strength is more vital, our intellect keener, and our understanding less clouded. We seem better able to cope with the world and to find our sphere of usefulness." In other words, joy is a superpower. It gives us strength, clarity, and resilience, and it helps us find our path, especially in helping others. I completely identify with what Abdu'l-Bahá says. As someone who has struggled with depression and anxiety my entire life, I find truth in his observation. Those occasions when I feel more joyful, I'm more focused, productive, and open to new experiences, and my mind and heart work in far greater harmony. Now, this is not a chapter on how to find joy. There are plenty of those works out there. In fact, Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama have an inspiring treatise called The Book of Joy. There are also about 3 gazillion books on happiness, how to find it, achieve it, and hold on to it. I don't have the space to explore this topic here, I'm afraid, but I will add another tremendous quote attributed to Abdu'l-Bahá. If you are so angry, so depressed, and so sore that your spirit cannot find deliverance and peace, even in prayer, then quickly go and give some pleasure to someone lowly or sorrowful, or to a guilty or innocent sufferer. Sacrifice yourself, your talent, your time, your rest to another, to one who has to bear a heavier load than you. I just love the message contained in all this profoundly spiritual and utterly practical teaching. Essentially, if you're feeling down, give happiness and comfort to someone who has it worse than you do. The spreading of joy, in other words, has a positive impact on one's own emotional state. This is what is referred to as pro-social behavior, and its efficacy has been backed up by innumerable studies in the field of positive psychology. Those who engage in altruistic behaviors have a greater sense of well-being than those who don't. Yet another example of where science and spirituality coalesce. Joy is a depleted resource these days, as is hope, the thing with feathers. In a world with so much discord and disunity, how do we nurture them? The International Governing Council of the Baha'i Faith, the Universal House of Justice, underlined a terrific way for all of us to move forward in a letter they wrote in 2020. They challenged Baha'is and others around the world to discover that precious point of unity where contrasting perspectives overlap and around which contending peoples can coalesce. This idea is both important and inspiring. Finding a precious point of unity is a path to finding hope. I remember speaking with the brilliant climate activist Callum Greaves, who works with Greta Thunberg as well as other youth activists, and he told me essentially the same thing. He was speaking about his work on climate change and told me of the clean air initiatives he had worked on. He said that people's opinions about climate change may differ in countless ways depending on their political point of view, but something like clean air is something that folks on all sides of the political spectrum can get behind. It doesn't matter if you think that climate change is some kind of liberal hoax or the greatest possible threat to our future. Everyone wants cleaner air for their children and grandchildren. It's the precious point of unity at the center of the climate conversation. And guess what? Cleaner air means less CO2 and other emissions that cause climate change. So win-win all around. The author Alexandra Rowland made quite a splash a few years ago when she introduced a concept for an entirely new genre of fiction. In response to the unwaveringly dark works of fantasies like Game of Thrones and the hundreds of despairing dystopian novels, films, and TV shows churned out each year, which are sometimes referred to as grimdark, she coined the term for the opposite, hope punk. Works of fiction in which a vulnerable and human protagonist fights against an unjust system and seeks to bring meaning, balance, and yes, hope to the world. She is quoted as saying, "Hope punk says that genuinely and sincerely caring about something, anything, requires bravery and strength. Hope punk isn't ever about submission or acceptance. It's about standing up and fighting for what you believe in. It's about standing up for other people. It's about demanding a better, kinder world and truly believing that we can get there if we care about each other as hard as we possibly can with every drop of power in our little hearts." Although Hope Punk's manifesto was built around the field of imaginary and speculative fiction, I envision the message and moniker spreading to ever wider pastures as we collectively demand a better, kinder world, as we don't shrug and retreat under the toxic wet blanket of pessimism and hopelessness. Sign me up. Let's weave Hope Punk into the altogether new myth and story of our species. And the better, kinder world that she speaks of is only possible if we rethink all those broken systems and start replacing them one by one. Reinvent adversarial systems. Over a decade ago, when cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin and several hundred others, and blockchain were first launched, there were hundreds of articles and blog posts written about how these new peer-to-peer digital currencies, not dependent on any banks or central governments, would change how money is used and would eventually transform the world for the better. Treatises were written about how crypto and blockchain would end poverty, revolutionize finance, and democratize banking tools. Although we've only been collectively exploring this crypto world for a little over 10 years, and there may still be some transformative benefit yet to be found, it currently seems to most to not be delivering on its promise. In fact, what started as an encouraging premise for those who work in its sphere has given way to the reality that the world of crypto is just as corrupt as other financial systems, if not more so. Why? Because this brilliant new concept that reinvents financial infrastructure is ultimately driven by the same greed that drives the old school systems. Instead of a coterie of banking and Wall Street elites raking in money from transactions, it's a somewhat larger and different coterie of crypto bros profiting at other people's expense. And there's no incentive to stabilize cryptocurrencies because the volatility itself leads to the variety of pump and dump, get-rich schemes that flood and define the crypto marketplace. One friend who worked in the field described it as a junkier stock market where the value of the currencies has zero correlation to performance. The market mania of crypto is driven purely by self-interest and not by any purported altruistic intentions to transform the economic system. The core of this system was built on the same old foundation of competition, self-interest, and greed. It is both a symptom of a deeper spiritual malady as well as something that exacerbates this imbalance. I'll provide an altogether different example that I believe best highlights what the opposite looks like. In her book, High Conflict, Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out, New York Times bestselling author and Wall Street Journal and Time journalist Amanda Ripley investigates a seemingly modern but most likely timeless and universal human issue, when conflict gradually morphs into something larger and more toxic than the original disagreement itself. Her work tracks people who are able to get out of the loop of blame and outrage and move into healthy conflict from which they're able to grow and evolve. Partisan politics and the divides it creates is one of her central topics. In her new book, she actually uses the Baha'i faith as an example and examines how it organizes and conceptualizes its elections. She says, Baha'i elections are to politics what meditation is to the legal system, a different game altogether, one designed to exploit the human capacity for cooperation rather than competition. In the Baha'i faith, there are no clergy, so the entire administrative system is made up of elected common folk who are in service to a larger idea. On the local level, every year a community town or city will elect 9 members to serve on what is called the local spiritual assembly. Every year, Baha'is at the district level elect delegates to vote for a governing body for their respective country called the National Spiritual Assembly. There are currently around 200 of these national governing councils. Every 5 years, the members of the national assemblies gather in Haifa, Israel, for the election of what is called the Universal House of Justice, a governing body that oversees the guidance of the entire Baha'i world. Ripley describes the process like this. Every spring, everyone in each of the 17,000 Baha'i locations gathers together to elect leaders. It's very close to a pure democracy, operating in 233 countries and territories. Here's a twist. Everything about these elections is designed to reduce the odds of high conflict. People are not allowed to campaign for a position or even discuss who might be the best person to serve. They can only discuss which qualities are most needed. These elections are undertaken in a completely unique fashion. There's no campaigning or electioneering. There are no nominations for potential positions or any kind of parties or coalitions to be formed either. Baha'is vote by secret ballot and are encouraged to choose those who are of unquestioned loyalty, of selfless devotion, of a well-trained mind, of recognized ability and mature experience, as Shoghi Effendi once wrote. Not only that, but the voting process is also undertaken in prayerful silence and meditation. According to Shoghi Effendi, the elector is called upon to vote for none but those whom prayer and reflection have inspired him to uphold. When you go to a Baha'i election, it is astonishingly different from any other you've ever witnessed in your life. A room full of silent, prayerful people in deep contemplation about who in their community shows the great faithfulness, sincerity, and competence. Voting is done in silent ballot fashion, and the tellers take great care to make sure no one's vote is known by others. No one makes position speeches. There are no fundraising emails, no yard signs. No canvassing or jockeying for position and favor. No debates, promises made, or gifts given to potential voters. In fact, if someone were to behave in a way that sought to draw attention to themselves so that they might seem worthy of a position, this probably would be perceived by the community as conceited and antithetical to the spirit of enlightened service. Ripley says, the Baha'is try to select people who do not crave attention and power. This is the opposite of traditional elections, of course, which self-select for people who yearn for recognition. She is essentially describing Socrates' proposal that a society should elect unwilling leaders because anyone who seeks a position of leadership is actually unfit for that position. The best ruler, according to Socrates, has no interest whatsoever in leading, but sees it ultimately as an obligatory service position. It is important to note that Baha'is who are elected to these various assemblies hold no special station above anyone else in the religion. Their opinions are not held with any greater esteem. They fulfill their duty as representatives only when in consultation with other members of the body to which they were elected and outside of the meeting have no authority or additional status. I've seen incredibly powerful videos capturing the diverse members of various national spiritual assemblies arriving from all over the world to assemble at the Baha'i World Center in Israel, where they prayerfully vote for the Universal House of Justice. The delegates, wearing their native dress, silently but joyfully stride up to the stage in a convention hall as the countries are called on in alphabetical order. The sight gives me the spiritual tingles, humanity at its very best. More than 1,000 radiant and humble servants dropping envelopes into a wooden box in an atmosphere of hushed reverence to elect the body of 9 believers who will guide the affairs of the Baha'i world. Ripley sums up her discussion about the Baha'i election process by saying, "If social scientists designed a religion, it would look like this." Compare that sublime vision to the reality of contemporary elections throughout the world, especially in the United States. Outraged yelling, bragging, and name-calling, months of hypocritical, vain posturing, while countless millions of dollars are spent, only to have nothing change. Let's envision how this process could work in the world at large. Let's imagine the small town of Pancake Flats, Colorado, which has a city council. The council members are getting fed up with divisive politics everywhere, even in their own little town. They decide that for the next election, they will all resign their positions and pass a city code to disallow any campaigning or partisanship. They ask the populace to come together to the high school stadium on election night and instruct them that they can vote for any person over 18 years old who lives within the city limits. They then ask the community members to contemplate consider all the people they have ever met and to ask themselves, who are the wise, upstanding human beings I know in Pancake Flats who passionately care about fairness for everyone? And we will find out on next week's program how this election turns out. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week and look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.